This is Rabbi Ethan Tucker of Mechon Hadar. Parashat Vizot HaBracha, 5777. Morasha Kehilat Yaakov. Closing Reflections 2. Halacha and Community. A long time ago, the sage Reish Lakish observed that even the Jews, who were seemingly the most removed from the tradition, were full of mitzvot like a pomegranate is full of seeds. Afilu reikanin shebach, melein mitzvot karimon. Not only does he describe a world full of observance, but he models what it looks like for rabbis and leaders to see commitment and connection in unexpected places. Today, by contrast, we live in a Jewish world that is commonly bifurcated into the observant and the non-observant, the halachic and the non-halachic, a world in which perhaps the greatest spiritual deficits that we face are those of trust and respect. Most rabbis engaged with halacha don't trust the average contemporary Jew, seeing emptiness, worthlessness, laziness, and a lack of commitment. And most contemporary Jews don't deeply value and engage the halachic tradition they have inherited, and whether for reasons of ignorance or ideology, can often hardly be said to be as full of mitzvot as a pomegranate is of seeds. Reish Lakish shows us, however, that it was not always so. So how did we take leave of that world, where rabbinic figures felt responsible for the wider Jewish community, who trusted and respected the people as part of the halacha conversation, who thought halacha was a morasha kihilat Yaakov, an inheritance of the entire community of Jacob, as we read in this week's parasha, and end up in our present moment? And is there any way for us to get back to that world of trust and respect? As we bring the year of Torah reading to a close in this final essay, we will explore this question, striving to understand the genesis of our present moment and begin to chart a way forward. Throughout the Middle Ages, rabbinic authorities and Jewish communities were responsible for all Jews. With the exception of those who actively converted out or those who actively took steps to separate themselves from the community, even Jews who might not have bought fully into rabbinic halacha were nonetheless under the purview of the political structure in which rabbis played a critical role. Sometimes this was aided by the small sizes of Jewish communities. It was always abetted by Gentile power structures that empowered rabbis to have privileged roles in governing their Jewish constituents. As a result, halacha was bound to the entire Jewish community and responsible to it. Emancipation allowed Jews, for the first time since the crystallization of rabbinic authority in the Middle Ages, to leave the Jewish community without serious consequences. Instead of being consigned to membership in vassal rabbinic states embedded within their European hosts, Jews were now invited to be citizens of the general society. Jewish political authority largely disappeared, though Jewish communities still administered funds distributed by the state to the various religious communities. But Jews in Europe steadily acculturated and assimilated, adopting patterns of living much more similar to their Gentile neighbors than to those of their ancestors. And rabbis in Jewish communities lost control over Jews, and thus lost formal responsibility for them as well. This dynamic would quickly present rabbis with a fateful choice. To what extent would they continue to live out the medieval model, imagining themselves to lead the entire population of Jews, despite the fact that the gulf between rabbinic expectations and common practice continued to widen? Or would they instead retreat into a smaller slice of the Jewish community, those who actively and publicly elected to sign on to the rabbinic project in their daily lives, speaking only to the audience that seemed keen to hear what they had to say? The split was particularly acute in late 19th century Germany. You can see the longer essay for some of the context, but put simply, the anti-reform camp in Germany broke into two parts. Some remained within the traditional communal structures that contained all Jews and sought to advance their own agenda of traditional observance, even as Jewish institutions were increasingly controlled by advocates of reform. Others decided to secede and form their own Orthodox community, essentially separating politically and communally from their co-religionists. They were dividing over a key question. Does the discourse of halakha and the community it is attached to need to stay in dialogue with those who are potentially leaving it? Ultimately, the European communities that grappled with these difficult issues, in Germany and elsewhere, were washed away by the flood of the Shoah. But the core questions remain with us until today. Indeed, the model of a truly secessionist, independent orthodoxy remains with us as the dominant form of orthodoxy until today. While America's strict separation of church and state makes religion a highly voluntaristic affair, the notion that orthodoxy must look out for orthodoxy, and that its halakha must look out for orthodox Jews, and largely ignore those outside of that political grouping, deeply defines the contours of halachic discourse in the United States up until the present. Even in Israel, where there is a Jewish government responsible for all citizens, and where religion and state remain intertwined, the dynamics of secessionist halakha remain very strong and preserve a discourse where halakha looks out for the needs and assumptions of quote-unquote religious Jews, who are presumed to be halakha's main relevant audience. This leads to crises on issues of marriage, divorce, and burial, to name just a few, where the entire population is subject to decisions formulated from a religious stance that is foreign and alien to them. The raison d'etre of a secessionist halakha is fairly obvious. It hopes to preserve religious commitment and integrity in the face of overwhelming apathy and antipathy. How can halakha engage with those who don't care about it or who scorn it? And if it did engage with those people, wouldn't it be hopelessly compromised, always shifting in the wind in order to make fair weather fans and destroying itself in the process? However we might assess the responses of 19th century German Jews to these questions, we must reevaluate them in our own time and place. And a close examination reveals that secessionist halakha has serious drawbacks as well, drawbacks that today outweigh any of its benefits. Here are these dangers in brief. First, a halachic myopia. Because it only engages with the self-selected community of the halachically faithful, secessionist halakha narrows its field of vision and highly limits the scope of issues it will deal with. When you see your constituency as made exclusively of those who already buy into a robust commitment to mitzvot, the scope of vision inevitably narrows. Isn't that amazing, given all of the endless numbers of tshuvot written by contemporary poskim, how relatively few of them address some of the toughest and cutting-edge issues that are religiously consuming for huge numbers of contemporary Jews? Where are the detailed tshuvot from the scholarly giants of the day that can really help people navigate issues of gender, sexuality, consumer responsibility, and fundamental questions of Jewish-Gentile boundaries? The relative quiet or even silence on these issues can be deafening and reveals the ways in which halakha has largely been blindfolded and had one hand, if not two hands, tied behind its back, as it is largely shielded from serious engagement with the most difficult issues of the day. A second danger is what I'll call scaling down the covenant. By writing off most Jews as irrelevant to the conversation, poskim stop looking for ways to understand their behavior and simply move to a stance of despair. It's a short step from there to giving up altogether on the Torah's mission to all Jews and the broader covenant of mitzvot and its claim on the entire Jewish people is thus compromised. A third danger is freeing people from the covenant and unmooring halakha from its constituents. This last weakness of secessionist halakha, which is essentially a cousin of the previous weakness, is the way in which secular Jews buy their freedom from the halachic conversation at the price of losing any input over its content. On a surface level, Jews who describe themselves as secular, non-halachic, or non-observant love secessionist halakha, which claims only to look out for halachic Jews and largely leaves them alone. Orthodox secessionists are generally uninterested in bringing secular Jews back to Jewish practice, and secular Jews are, for this reason, often fans of the dynamics of secessionist halakha, which offers them the benefit of being left alone. Indeed, many Jews would fight tooth and nail any sort of halachic regime that made a claim on them as imperialist and coercive. In reality, however, it rarely works out that way. Jews end up confronting the legacy of halachic choices and dynamics in one way or another, whether it be through the state of Israel, through relatives, or through the people their children fall in love with, and they thus end up returning to the table of halachic conversation in one way or another. Secessionist halacha conspires to leave them out of that conversation and deprives them of any internal voice in shaping it. Which more deeply respects autonomy, I will ask you, to exempt someone from taxes or to grant them representation in Congress? Is it really more respecting of a given Jew's religious choices to grant them freedom while writing them out of the halachic language of the covenant? Or is it actually more respectful to articulate expectations and obligations of all Jews and therefore assume that their questions and concerns must shape the kinds of issues poskim must grapple with? Paradoxically, making a more imperialistic claim of the obligatory scope of halacha makes it more responsive and gives it a broader constituency. For all these reasons and others, the current state of halacha is in trouble. The discourse of halacha has become unmoored from the people it is trying to guide, and most Jews are not sufficiently committed to make a claim on halacha and to expect that it ought to respond to their reality. Or to put both of these points together in a single thought, halacha and the Jewish people have become deeply, mutually alienated one from the other. We must move away from the secessionist halacha that has reinforced these dynamics and find a way to return to the world of Reish Lakish, in which mitzvot are ubiquitous, and those engaged with the language of halacha can see that reality and take it seriously. So how do we do that? I want to suggest six critical steps for making this a reality. Three are devoted to ways in which we reimagine the halachic enterprise, and three are devoted to ways in which we reimagine our expectations of the Jewish community. Please see the longer essay for a fuller articulation of each of them. Let's begin with the ways in which our halachic discourse must change. First, we need a halacha that is real, not just ideal. For too long now, in an effort to preserve an idealized version of the past, and in the name of riding out the storm of modernity, halachic sources have been used to construct an abstract ideal space of practice and commitment into which the messy details of the real world must be shoehorned. Too many contemporary thinkers advocate applying halachic strictures to the world from behind a veil of ignorance. Rather than seeing the world and life as a mere shadow of the idyllic space of Torah, we must return Torah to its rightful place as the guide for navigating the lives we actually lead. This is the way rabbinic sources always worked, with their enthusiasm for responding to bidiavad, or post-facto situations. Teachers and preachers of halacha should respond directly to our challenges and our realities, pushing us to advance the cause of Torah within the world we live in. Second, we need to learn to respect religious instincts. Teachers of halacha must take seriously the religious assumptions and instincts of any sincere person. Why? Well, for starters, they are often grounded in something real, a kernel of wisdom that might at first be overlooked, but upon second inspection unlocks a deeper truth heretofore unrevealed. I remember years ago hearing someone talking about how they tried not to lie on Shabbat. When I first heard this, it sounded silly to me, completely unmoored from the discourse of milacha that defines Shabbat prohibitions. But then, I later discovered that the Talmud Yerushalmi asserts that this practice was common in its own day, and that this entitles someone to rely on an otherwise untrustworthy person if they attest to the kashrut of a given food on Shabbat. And indeed, on further reflection, not lying on Shabbat is part of a quest to create a more perfect space and time, one in which deception takes a break for a day, along with all the other toils of the week. To ignore those gems of wisdom and insight is to be religiously and halachically impoverished. But even more centrally, if we hope to recapture a world in which all Jews are full of mitzvot, We must begin in part by seeking out the halachic instincts of average Jews. Those instincts must be engaged, probed, and often challenged, but also used as fulcrums with which to leverage a deeper investigation of halachic discourse. Im einam nevi'im, b'nei nevi'im hem. All Jews are the disciples of prophets. Their religious instincts are thus ipso facto commanding of our attention and respect. And third, we need to avoid sectarianism. A healthy halakha that seeks a broad base of support will cultivate an allergy to legal formulations that leave too many people comprehensively shut out of the conversation. Religious leaders surely must work to inspire deeper commitment and to change behaviors, but there's a wide gap between increasing and intensifying observance and constructing a halakha that could only ever plausibly be followed by a tiny minority of the Jewish people. Even if practitioners of halakha reorient themselves along the lines I have suggested so far, the contemporary Jewish community must still do three things, and this is the tougher part to hear. The first relates to questions of tone, the second relates to curriculum, and the third relates to self-respect and integrity. A first challenge for the community is to embrace normativity. The Jewish community, particularly in North America, would be strengthened by coming to terms with the fact that we are all free individuals who are at liberty to lead whatever kind of life we want. The emancipation is complete, and there is no real obstacle to the fullest expressions of individual autonomy. Against that backdrop, it should always be assumed that anyone has the right, and more importantly, the power, to disagree with any rabbinic or communal pronouncement on any topic without any real consequences other than those that are self-imposed. And therefore, given that there is no vestige of medieval coercive power, at least in the diaspora, it is responsible and necessary to build communities that unapologetically embrace and advocate knowledge and observance of mitzvot. If you want halakha to be healthy, responsive, and vibrant, it must be allowed a space to be articulated without irony and without apology. The notion that I can only protect individual autonomy by censoring the notion of normativity is toxic to reviving a normative language that can guide us through life's challenges. I so desperately want to live in a world where I never hear someone express discomfort about the fact that someone offered a normative opinion. That energy and discomfort, to the extent it exists, should be channeled into discussing the substance of the norms in question. Too many, too often, assume that normative statements are cudgels wielded against deviant Jews, labeling them as bad, guilty, or unfaithful. We could be so much stronger as a community if we would embrace the notion of norms as articulated and projected expectations that in fact take people seriously and invite them to aspire to more thoughtful and directed forms of behavior. Rules need not be seen as an opportunity for rebellion. Instead, in an autonomous culture, they are invitations to step into Jewish normative discourse, into halakha, as full citizens and participants in its conversation. A second thing communities and institutions can do is to revive halakha by teaching it. It's uncomfortable to say it, but it is undeniably true. Outside many, not all, Orthodox institutions, the North American Jewish community simply does not teach halakha, whether to its congregants, to its school children, to its educators, or sadly, even to its rabbis. Curricula and competence are stubborn facts that are not easily evaded. Most North American rabbis have never been trained to read sources like the Beit Yosef, the Shach, the Petrei Tshuva, or a responsum of Rav Ovadia Yosef with confidence and fluency. Their voices are thus sadly excluded from the deeper aspects of halachic conversation, and they have not been empowered to say something creative in its rich language. This obviously reflects nothing about abilities. It reflects curricular choices that assume that the discourse of halakha is for someone else, and therefore not worth investing in. Only by insisting that all of our leaders enter into this discourse can we refresh and reanimate it. And the third is to take our Jewish lives seriously. This is where all of us play a critical role, and we must vote with our feet and restore through our actions the omnipresence of mitzvot in the Jewish community. If we expect halacha to respond to our lives as lived, then those lives need to be full of commitment and worthy of respect. We're all constantly called upon to answer the charge of the prophet Malachi, Hakriveu na lefecha techa, hayirtzecha, o hayisafanecha, offer this sacrifice to your local governor. Would he accept it? Would he show you favor on its account? We must honestly ask ourselves, would we put the quality and intensity of our Jewish lives on a par with what would pass for excellence in the secular world? Don't we need to meet that standard if we expect generations past, as embodied in halachic sources, to take us seriously enough to admit us into their timeless conversation? Contemporary Jews disagree on a host of ideological points, but we ought to be able to be honest about what levels of commitment exude a sense of bearing the weight of Jewish culture and practice in a way that would be respected in hindsight generations from now. Can my community point to a strong prayer space that functions on a daily basis? Can my community provide a home for someone seeking peer reinforcement for consistent weekly observance of Shabbat? Do those who lead services in my community know their craft and inspire confidence and religious aspiration? Do people punctiliously tithe their incomes for tzedakah, understanding, as did all prior generations, that their income is not truly theirs? Is my community a sustainable model of religious commitment, whether by training true scholars or by baking matzah, such that I would be confident for the future of Judaism if it were up to me and those in my community? In short, can I look myself in the mirror and honestly say, when compared to committed Jews and Jewish communities of the past, yes, I measure up. I am a proud member of this storied community of history. Because only if we can answer these questions in the affirmative will we ever be able to have the self-respect to demand respect from those who preceded us. We must aspire to a level of integrity that we would expect others to be able to see. We can only fairly demand things of the conversation of the ages if we take full ownership of our place within it. These are the standards that motivate me. As a contributing member of Jewish communities and as a parent, I am always asking myself whether I am measuring up. And when I make my contributions to halachic discourse, I do so with the goal of advancing a halacha that can match Reish Lakish's vision of Jewish community. Throughout this year, we have explored so many different texts and issues. My hope is that this final essay has offered some second-order reflection on why so many of those texts were important to me, and how we might think of them in ways that implicitly advance a vision of Jewish community as well. No question is too tough, no text is too far afield, no personal instinct too idiosyncratic not to demand our attention. And I invite you to join me and Rabbi Avi Killip on Responsa Radio, www.responsaradio.org, where we have created a forum for precisely that. We are accountable to our texts, to read them precisely, to answer to their demands, and to the extent we think about something differently than they seem to ask ourselves why that is so, and to craft a narrative that will account both for what we have inherited and what we experience. And we have always placed values at the center, insisting that our foray into halacha is always a quest for a life of meaning. All of these commitments are in fact implicit corollaries of a commitment to a covenantal vision of Jewish community. All Jews are commanded, and therefore all texts are accountable to them. There is no easy evasion of religious obligation, just as there is no avoiding the Torah's accountability to all Jews. I firmly believe that this is the pathway forward to a world in which mitzvot, once again, are the unifying anchor of our people. Afilu rekanin shebach meleim mitzvot karimon. Let us work hard towards a vision of a community where even seemingly empty places are full of values, full of purpose, full of integrity, and full of commitment.